The war in Iran continues this week, and it's not just oil prices that are a casualty. Will this war kill off NATO? We'll get the latest on today's Trumpet World. Welcome to Trumpet World, the week in review, where we have a rundown of the most important news of the week based on Bible prophecy. I'm here on the road. We're actually recording this in front of the Rhine River, not necessarily because it has anything to do with what we're talking about today, but it does make a nicer backdrop than me sitting in our hotel room, I guess. So we're away from our usual format. We'll have each panel member send in a report from their region. And we'll start by getting an update on the Iran war and the wider Middle East from Mihailo Zekic.
The main stories this week in the Middle East revolve around the Arab world joining the war. Last Saturday, the Houthi group, the Shiite terror group that controls half of Yemen, joined the war with its sponsor Iran against the West by sending two missiles towards Israel and the southern city of Eilat. Now, if you remember from the October 7th war, the Houthis were the main vehicle Iran used to disrupt merchant shipping in the Red Sea and elsewhere. They're one of Iran's most heavily armed proxy groups. It was a bit of a question on when, not if, the Houthis would come into play. Thus far, their attacks have been relatively limited, and while the U.S. has retaliated against the Houthis, the counterattack from the West has been limited as well, certainly not as grand as what we saw a couple of years ago. But the main story I want to focus on is reports that the Gulf Arabs may actually join the war against Iran with Israel and the United States. On April 1st, the Wall Street Journal published an exclusive claiming that the UAE is planning on formally entering the war to attack Iran so it can get its oil exported to the rest of the world. According to Arab officials, quote, "The UAE is lobbying for a United Nations Security Council resolution that would authorize such action. Emirati diplomats have urged the U.S. and military powers in Europe and Asia to form a coalition to open the strait by force." A UAE official said the Iranian regime thinks it is fighting for its existence and is willing to bring the global economy down with it in a chokehold on the strait. End quote. Now, again, a bit of context, the Strait of Hormuz is that waterway that connects the Persian Gulf and all these oil-producing countries with the rest of the wider world. By closing it, Iran is basically killing the only thing these countries have to keep their economy afloat. According to the journal sources, the UAE was using Bahrain, another Gulf Arab country that relies on fossil fuel exports and is a close partner with the U.S. The UAE is using them to sponsor the resolution. They sit on the UN Security Council. They don't have veto power, though. And on Thursday, the Associated Press saw a final draft of the proposal that Bahrain was putting together. Now, the original draft said the countries could, quote, use all necessary means to open the Strait of Hormuz. That's basically UN speak for potentially authorizing a peacekeeping operation. Iran's allies that do have veto power, Russia and China, as well as France, said they didn't like that, so Bahrain revised the language to say instead, quote, "use all defensive means necessary and commensurate with the circumstances in the Strait of Hormuz and adjacent waters," end quote. Now, UN resolutions in general, there's a lot of negotiation that comes into the language. Usually they're intentionally vague and open to interpretation while trying to make the people that don't like what's happening not look bad. And use all defensive means necessary. That the UAE would have been using defensive maneuvers anyway. They were attacked, as we talked about on this program before. They were the ones that Iran bombed when this war started, and adjacent waterways, that counts basically, you could say, the entire Persian Gulf. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. The vote is happening tomorrow. But If we see this actually get approved somehow, there's a decent chance it won't, and there's a decent chance the Arab countries aren't even planning on getting approved. They might just be saber-rattling on their part to get Iran to back down. But if it does, we would literally see Arab countries fighting an active war against Iran side by side with Israel. That is unprecedented. The UAE and Bahrain, they have relations with Israel. They don't need to, there's no diplomatic red tape to cut at this point. If they wanted to, they could do this. And the reason we're interested here at the Trumpet with this story is a prophecy in Psalm 83, which we spoke about on this program over and over again, about an alliance of so-called moderate Arab countries forming together in this end time, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. That's in verse 4. Mr. Fleury, our editor-in-chief, discusses in his free book, The King of the South, we could put a link in the show notes, about this prophecy and how that it is a prophecy and it's being fulfilled right now. And included in that prophecy in verse 6 is the Ishmaelites, which even Muslim tradition will show you, or the ancestors of the Peninsula Arabs, the people that live in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, these countries today. And they're going to be a part of this alliance too. And although this is an alliance made against Israel, and not just the state of Israel, but also includes the United States and other English-speaking countries, you can request a free copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy if you'd like to learn more. But while this alliance is forming against Israel, as Mr. Fleury details in The King of the South, one of the impetuses that this alliance forms in the first place is to be united against Iran, a moderate Arab military alliance against Iran. And we're literally seeing some of these countries getting ready to declare war on Iran itself and want to have help from the international community, want a bunch of countries to come together to counter Iran. And Israel hasn't said much about this, but I think it's pretty clear this is something Israel would support, especially if countries like the UAE, which they have good relations with, were spearheading this. Mr. Fleury wrote an article in 2021 called Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals, or at least it was published in 2021, that commentated on the Abraham Accords the previous year and Israel and opening up relations with the UAE and with Bahrain, these two countries that are involved right now. And Mr. Fleury said that this is a trap. Israel is helping build up the Psalm 83 alliance. They're encouraging it, and they're completely blind to what this alliance is going to end up doing with them. A lot of time has passed between 2021 and the current war now. And never mind just breaking out diplomatic relations. We could literally see Israel and these Arab countries fighting side by side in a war. Israel literally helping the military aspect of this alliance come together. Again, anything can happen. The vote is on Saturday, but we need to keep our eyes on that vote and keep our eyes on what Israel is doing with these Gulf countries and with other Arab states. One more story, a bit of a different direction. On March 30th, Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa visited Berlin for an audience with German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. The subject of the discussion was on how Germany can support Syria's reconstruction now that the civil war is over, now the Assad regime is out of the picture. The visit itself was quite controversial because Sharaa, as we've discussed on this program before, is a former Al-Qaeda operative. His government still has worrying connections to jihadism and terrorism. But the main thing I want to focus on for the purposes of this segment is that among the events, Merz called for 80% of the Syrian refugees in Germany to be sent back to Syria very soon. That's over 1 million people altogether, how many Syrians are in Germany. For that kind of internal deportation would be on a massive scale, and it's unclear if Merz will be able to accomplish that just yet. But if that were to go through, and apparently this has Shiraz's support, you could see why both leaders would want this. A, it sends, for as far as the Syrian government is concerned, it sends a lot of people that would have had been able to develop wealth, get some educational expertise, have connections with one of the most powerful economies in the world, moving back and helping build up the country. And Merz, for his part, was elected on an anti-immigrant platform, more or less. And obviously for Germany, the influx of refugees from the Muslim world has been extremely controversial for a long time. This is supposed to address that. But this would not just be, say, you hear about in the United States, they're talking about internal deportations and sending people back across the border. This would be on a very different magnitude from even something like that. If for nothing else, that a lot of these people at this point, well, they have legal status in Germany at the moment, but because of that, they've been able to integrate themselves into German society in various ways. They have German jobs. Again, they've been able to develop wealth. Some of their children may speak German as their primary language now. They'll have family in Germany. They would have been able to intermarry. This would basically be sending a bunch of Germanized Syrians, people that have been assimilated into society, that have business connections, back into a country that has been hemorrhaging people, that doesn't have that many people in the first place, and essentially be German-Syrian colonists, almost, creating a cultural link between Syria and Germany that would still be ongoing. I'm sure there would still be business connections going between the two countries. People would still have the family connections that they wouldn't have otherwise. Speaking of Psalm 83, the prophecy also mentions the Hagarenes, the ancient inhabitants of Syria, being a part of this alliance. And Mr. Fleury has said that this indicates Syria is going to be part of this alliance too. And you also have Asher or Assyria, a biblical prophetic word for Germany, being included in this as well. And as Mr. Fleury says in Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals, Germany is really the brains behind this alliance. And if this deportation goes ahead, with the blessings of both governments, this could help lay another foundation for this alliance in a massive way. But anyway, these are the stories from the last week from the Middle East, and now back to our host, Mr. Richard Palmer.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. While NATO is quickly becoming a casualty of the Iran war, at the start of the conflict, Europe refused to get involved. That shifted this week to being more actively hostile, or actively trying to frustrate the United States. This week, Spain, after previously refusing the US access to its airbase, banned any American planes involved in the war from the entirety of their airspace. When they initially banned the bases, President Trump was pretty angry. He criticized Spain for being uncooperative and threatened to cut off all trade for the nation. Then Italy, a few days ago, refused to allow several US aircraft involved with the war to land on their Sigonella base in Sicily. They blamed technicalities or the fact that a permission hadn't been granted before the flight plan took off. But it's still quite a disturbance to the United States. President Trump criticized France as well earlier in the week. He said the country of France won't let planes headed to Israel loaded with military supplies fly over French territory. France has been very unhelpful with respect to the butcher of Iran, who has been successfully eliminated. The USA will remember. Then Germany last week, the president spoke out. He called the attack on Iran a violation of international law. And Britain, too, sadly, has been one of the most obstructionist nations as well, part of that, I think, is a humiliation of our own military. We just can't do much. We've been so weakened, but they've been doing very little even to help America defend our own military bases. But Eurointelligence wrote this week that it looks like European countries had coordinated an attempt to block the United States and frustrate the war, the way that you had all of these countries closing air bases or airspaces all at once. They wrote, the transatlantic alliance has already been called into question by Trump's own actions, but it will not recover from Europe's coordinated refusal to help the US in this war. And I think this was a pretty big surprise, the restriction of these bases in particular to the United States. America's bases in Europe, they're kind of different bases, even in the same country, have different terms and conditions as to when and where America is allowed to use them. But generally, I think American politicians and leaders have assumed, well, we paid a lot of money to maintain these bases. In many cases, America paid a lot of money to build the bases in the first place. They tend to say, well, you European countries, you benefit from having these bases here. It protects your country. In many cases, it even boosts the economy. And American spending by American military personnel at these bases are a major factor in the economy of some of these countries. And they say, well, there's a lot of countries that would love to host American military bases for all of these reasons. But America then expects to be able to use these bases, particularly in something like the Iran war that keeps Europe safe. Iran has proven it can hit Europe with missiles. So for then a lot of European countries to turn around and say, no, no bases, you can't use these bases, and that might be the final nail in NATO's coffin. And after this refusal, you had a couple of statements, one from Donald Trump himself. He was talking to The Telegraph. He said, I was never swayed by NATO. I always knew they were a paper tiger, and Putin knows that too, by the way. And then he was asked in the course of that interview if he would rethink America's participation in NATO. And he said, I would say it's beyond reconsideration. You know, America's participation is done. We're not rethinking it. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, he had similar statements. He said, I do think, unfortunately, we're going to have to re-examine whether or not this alliance that has served this country well for a while is still serving that purpose. And I think those statements from Marco Rubio might actually be the more significant of the two. If you think about the European Security Conference, J.D. Vance was the bad cop and went over there and gave Europe a telling off. And Marco Rubio was the good cop. And he went there and said, in substance, something quite similar to J.D. Vance, but with a lot more positive of a message. He's the one that has been one of the biggest voices within the Trump administration for remaining in NATO and the value of NATO. So to have Marco Rubio change and say, well, we're not even sure what the point of this is. I think for a lot of people in the United States, a lot of people in the administration, they weren't that keen on what Donald Trump was saying and doing about Greenland. And for sure, Donald Trump has done a lot to undermine NATO already. But the behavior of Europe this last week has caused a lot of the more pro-NATO people within the Trump administration to say, well, actually, this alliance seems pretty one-sided. And we're doing a lot for this alliance and they're doing nothing for us. And we have one of the rare opportunities where they could do something for us. Really, America is still meeting the bulk of the cost of the war in Iran. This was a relatively little thing. It's just permission that America assumed would be granted and kind of thought was at least already implied. And then when NATO says no, well, what's the point of this alliance? Now, Donald Trump lacks the power to unilaterally withdraw from NATO, and some are kind of saying, well, that's going to stop him from destroying NATO or from pulling America out of NATO. It would require a two-thirds vote in Congress to do that, and they're not going to get that majority. That's true, but Donald Trump is commander-in-chief. NATO fundamentally relies on the promise from America to defend Europe, and if the commander-in-chief says, we're not going to defend Europe, if a European country is attacked, we're not sending our troops, well, that's it. That is functionally the end of NATO. It might still exist on paper. America might still be a member. So Donald Trump can just destroy NATO, and he could refuse advanced weapons. He could refuse intelligence sharing. He's got lots and lots of other options. And I think it's really interesting that it was Europe that really put this final nail in the coffin. And again, I don't want to say all of the disintegration of the relationship in NATO is all on Europe. There was the whole kind of fracas over Greenland, and Donald Trump has questioned and undermined it before. But it was very much on Europe this week that took a very deliberate, calculated step that I think could well be the final nail in the coffin. Why did they do that? Well, Eurointelligence, in their write-up, they made a really interesting point where they said they don't see how the EU can stand up on its own, apart from American support in NATO, without a political and fiscal union. And in more dramatic language, that's a superstate. They can't stand alone without becoming a superstate. And that's right. That's what it would take is for the EU to come together and wean itself off of its economic and military dependence on the United States. And I think that is why Europe just took the chance to finally torpedo NATO this week. All the way back in 2008, talking about Germany undermining NATO with these gas pipelines to Russia, Mr. Flurry wrote that Germany also wants to eliminate NATO. He wrote, many elite Germans feel their nation has now gotten all it can from the United States and they're ready to move on. Some powerful Germans today are thinking more and more about the Holy Roman Empire and they want modern Germany to assume more power of its own in the spirit of that empire. That's, I think, what was behind a lot of this. There are people that want Europe to be able to stand alone. And so torpedo NATO, you've got the kind of crisis building now that will help force them into becoming a superstate. One final quote from that article. Mr. Flurry wrote, Jeremiah 1 and verse 13 records God showing a prophetic vision of a seething pot, and the face thereof is towards the north. This symbolic language is describing modern Germany. Beneath the surface, that nation is full of simmering dissatisfaction with the current world order. Germans are angry at the US, and especially furious with President Trump. The imperialistic ambition that propelled Germany to start both world wars is alive and well. It is seething. That, I think, is the motivation behind getting rid of NATO. And if you want to read more, I'd point you to the latest, or the issue of the Trumpet magazine that came out just before the Iran war. It's called The World is Uniting Against America. You know, many expected the Iran war to rally Europe and America together. I even had people write in and say, well, you know, that issue is completely obsolete. Europe and America, they're coming together in the face of Iran. And that hasn't happened. Instead, America remains alone, Europe standing on the other side. Well, we'll get an update now from Andrew to get the picture from the United States, and then Jeremiah Jacques will give the latest from Asia.
Since the beginning of the U.S.-Iran war, roughly 1 month ago now, central banks around the world have been dumping U.S. Treasury bonds. Latest statistics I've seen shows that these banks have dumped about $82 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds, which has brought the amount of U.S. Treasury bonds held by central banks at the New York Fed down to $2.7 trillion, which still sounds like a lot, but it's actually the lowest amount of U.S. Treasury bonds held by central banks since 2012. So about 14 years ago. And we'll keep an eye on this going forward. We're having some news reports that the Strait of Hormuz is starting to opening up, and that might slow the flight away from the dollar. The main impetus for dumping these treasury bonds is the closure of the Strait of Hormuz made oil prices go up since oil's tightly linked to the dollar. That made the dollar stronger or worth more in relation to other currencies. So many central banks who didn't want their currencies to go up too much have been dumping dollars to support their own currencies. But backing up and taking a big picture overview as to why this is important is if banks start dumping treasury bonds like they're doing, it will make the interest rates on treasury bonds go up in a way to encourage them to buy more, which has happened. And then as this goes up, that makes the price of borrowing money go up, which is a huge problem for the U.S. government because the U.S. government already spends 20% of every tax dollar it collects just on interest on the national debt. So if nations start dumping treasury bonds, the interest rate's going to go up, and they're going to start spending more than 20% of tax revenue collected on the interest on the national debt. And if this continues for too long, the dollar loses its reserve currency status. It will find itself unable to sell treasury bonds. And since it runs a $1 to $2 trillion deficit every year, if it can't borrow that money, it has to print it, and inflation's going up. So we're definitely seeing some really important financial jitters right now based on prophecies in Leviticus 26 about other nations lending to you and you not lending to them. The national debt is prophesied, and the Philadelphia Trumpet has long forecast that the dollar would lose its reserve currency status. Right now, a lot of the dollar's reserve currency status is tied to the fact that dollars are the currency nations around the world use to buy oil. So the dollar is not backed by gold like it used to be. It's basically backed by oil. The Saudi Arabians agreed to buy U.S. Treasury bonds in return for the United States defending them and defending the Strait of Hormuz. So if there's now questions about whether the United States is willing or able to defend that strait, you can expect nations to start dumping treasury bonds. That's what we're seeing. And that's why these dollar reserves are going down. And more people are starting to talk about the end of the petrodollar. Again, like, this is definitely something that's prophesied, that, like, a nation that turns away from God, like, will have a national debt. The Bible phraseology is others will lend to you and you won't lend to them. So we're definitely expecting the dollar to lose its reserve currency status. We can't predict exactly when, but that is one of the big takeaways from this conflict with Iran. Is nations losing faith in the U.S.'s ability to defend the Strait of Hormuz, and not just talking about how the United States isn't able to do it, but actually putting their money where their mouth is and dumping treasury bonds as well. In other news in the Anglo-American speaking world, the Supreme Court did a big case that could end up being a landmark case. It isn't a final ruling yet, but there was a lower court case in Colorado where Colorado had made it illegal for psychologists and other mental health counselors to try to give people psychiatric counsel that would change the sex they're attracted to, like someone experiencing same-sex attraction. If you go to a psychologist, they couldn't tell them that was wrong or give them advice on how to stop that. This is something that the Supreme Court has now come in and said that law is violating the free speech rights of the psychologist. And they've thrown this case back to the lower court. They haven't made a final ruling. They've thrown it back to the lower court and said, well, apply more thorough legal scrutiny based on the fact that this law is violating their free speech. And so we're still waiting for the lower court decision, but this could be another big free speech victory in America, allowing psychologists and other counselors, especially Christian ones, to actually give people advice based on the Bible without having a state law criminalizing that speech. Also, we've got a new acting attorney general. President Trump fired Attorney General Pam Bondi yesterday. No official word on the reason for the firing. The official statement just said that she's transitioning to an important job in the private sector that will hear more about soon. But then putting in a new attorney general, or acting attorney general for now, Todd Blanche, who's made some pretty strong statements in the past about liberal judges waging lawfare against President Trump and, more importantly, against the Constitution. So we've definitely been disappointed many times in the past with attorney generals who weren't willing to uphold the law in the United States. But it seems like this new one, the way he's talking at the beginning, may start to do some aggressive prosecution and forcing some of those who have, especially on the radical left, who have been flouting the Constitution and have flouting American laws for a long time, holding them to account. And then one final news story from Canada this time. The Stay Free Alberta movement's made an official announcement that they've now collected enough signatures, 10% of the Alberta electorate, roughly 178,000 signatures, to put a question on their next election in Alberta on whether those voting think Alberta should stay part of Canada or not. Any public polls I've seen on this issue shows that probably only about 20% of Albertans want to secede from Canada. So I don't think anyone's thinking they've got the public support to actually go through with this. But they do have the public support of about 10% of the people to at least put a question on a referendum. So on October 19th, we will actually get some realistic numbers on exactly what percent of Alberta wants to leave Canada. So again, that's just another indication of rising political division in both the U.S. and Canada, this particular case being in Canada, that we should have some more reliable numbers on in October.
America's security alliance with South Korea has stood for more than seven decades as a pillar of the U.S.'s strategy to check Asian aggression and to maintain stability across the region. This framework has been of immense strategic value to America, and it has also been invaluable to South Korea. But in the last few years, some real fissures have emerged in this pillar, and it is slowly cracking apart. There was an analysis about this in The Diplomat this week, published on Monday. It's called, "Is South Korea About to Finally Get Full Control of Its Own Military?" And this piece takes a close look at some of the history of the U.S.-South Korea alliance. That alliance, of course, dates back to the early 1950s with the Korean War. At that time, the U.S. intervened and prevented South Korea from being conquered by North Korea. And at that time, South Korean authorities transferred operational control of their armed forces to the United Nations Command, which was under the control of the United States. That is called OPCON, or Operational Control. And the details of this framework have changed a little bit over the years, and South Korea did eventually regain peacetime operational control. But were a war to break out on the Korean Peninsula tomorrow, it would still flip back to the United States. That fundamental part of the deal has not changed. If war broke out tomorrow, a United States four-star general would be in charge of South Korean forces, along with U.S. forces who are stationed in South Korea. So that's the situation right now. But U.S. President Donald Trump has been very unhappy about this alliance. He doesn't seem to have that Reagan-esque kind of desire to support America's fellow democracies, and he doesn't seem to understand the immense strategic value that the alliance with South Korea gives to America. Even in his first term, he was saying that South Korea needed to quintuple the amount that it was paying America for the deal. And then this time around, he has continued to apply pressure about the burden sharing. And to that, he has also added very heavy-handed tariff pressure placed on South Korea, putting rates on them far higher even than those that we've placed on some nations that are not even allies of the United States. And he has basically just told South Korea over and over again that they need to be ready to fend for themselves. And the South Koreans are starting to take this very seriously. They don't know what President Trump might do next week or next year, or if the United States, under his very erratic leadership, would even come to their defense if they were attacked. So they have been pushing to regain OPCON, even in wartime. Back in January, South Korean President Lee Jae-myung said, "Self-reliant national defense is the most basic of basics amid the unstable international situation. It would be unacceptable for South Korea to be unable to protect itself." And President Lee has made other similar statements over the years, as have other South Korean authorities. But we can't really blame all of this friction entirely on President Trump. There has really been an undercurrent for decades among certain South Koreans for just more of a desire for military sovereignty. They know that no other U.S. ally, not Japan, not Germany, or any other nation, operates in a system in which their troops would be automatically subordinated to a U.S. commander during wartime. So a lot of South Koreans have long found this a little bit humiliating, and they've long wanted to have control over their own armed forces. So really, President Trump and his approach and his unpredictability, it's only added to the urgency of those who have long sought to regain full OPCON for South Korea. But the urgency is growing. The South Koreans hear President Trump loud and clear when he tells them to stop thinking that they can rely on America and to get ready to fend for themselves. And they are moving in that direction. And it means cracks in this alliance are getting deeper. This pillar of global security is beginning to bust apart. And if current trends persist, the U.S.-South Korea alliance could soon be rubble. And this is something that the trumpet has been expecting. Biblical prophecy discusses a group of Asian nations that will come together in the modern era. You can read passages all about this alliance in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Revelation especially. And they show that Russia and China will be the main nations of this Asian bloc. These passages show that they'll be the primary leaders of the bloc, especially Russia. But the biblical passages also show that smaller Asian nations, including the Koreas, will end up throwing their power behind this Russian-led bloc. So when we view those prophecies alongside other prophecies about a decline in American global power, then it becomes clear that the days are numbered for America's alliance with South Korea. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has a booklet. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that examines all the various prophecies about this Asian confederacy. This booklet shows that this confederacy will play a key role in the most violent conflict in mankind's history. But Mr. Fleury also shows that these developments are tied to some very good news. After this conflict ends, he says that there will be a, quote, peaceful and prosperous new age for the entire earth, end quote. So it's certainly not all bad news. And for anyone who would like to understand that, I hope that you'll go to thetrumpet.com and pick up your free copy of that booklet. Once again, it's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And then I have just one other quick story here about Japan fortifying islands in the East China Sea. It's normally China who we hear about building up its military assets on islands across this region as it prepares for war. But Japan has been very fearful of the Chinese buildup and very mindful of China's increasing belligerence in the region. So in recent years, Japan has also been greatly increasing its military presence across a whole string of islands in the region. These islands stretch from the southwestern point of Japan's main islands all the way to the east coast of Taiwan. So all across this string, the Japanese have installed radar systems and air defense systems and anti-ship missile units and ammunition depots. They've also stationed thousands of Japanese soldiers. Japan sees that current trends are leading to war, and they want to be prepared. So it's a remarkable buildup that is underway there. The Wall Street Journal spotlighted this on Monday, and it shows that tensions between Japan and China are worsening. The two are becoming more and more fearful of each other, and they're amassing more and more firepower. But biblical prophecy shows that Japan and China will soon lay aside their differences, and they will unite under Russian leadership. And our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, provides some details about how we expect this dramatic detente and alliance between Japan and China to happen.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah, and thank you to all of our correspondents. One more very quick story just before we finish up. Artemis 2 successfully launched towards the moon this week. They've had a few issues, I think mostly with their toilet, so I guess important, but perhaps not mission critical. But it's heading in a good direction. It's an exciting story that seeing man return to the moon, not landing on it, orbiting around it, but very much on track to have man back on the moon. And it's traveling right now during the spring holy days, during the days of unleavened bread, at the same time that, well, I'm on the road and we're traveling at this time of year to visit some of our brethren around Europe. Israel came out of slavery in Egypt with a high hand during these holy days. And in the morning brief, when that rocket launched on Wednesday, I think it was, Mr. Hilliker wrote that God wants to free us from our bondage to sin, just as he freed the Israelites. cleanse Earth entirely, then ultimately use this planet as a staging ground for mankind's help in freeing the vast universe from its bondage to decay. And this launch is a wonderful opportunity to consider man's destiny and the freedom that's coming to the entire universe. And I had the opportunity to guest host the Trumpet Daily earlier in the week. We talked about that more. That was on Wednesday's show. You can find that on YouTube or on Rumble. We've got a lot more as well in our fantastic booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential, that really works to bring this alive. We'd love to send that to you. And all the other material that we've mentioned on the show today, you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. But thank you so much for joining us on this bit of an irregular program. Thank you to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production and his flexibility in helping put this together. We'll be back in a more regular fashion next week. Until then, keep watching your world.